of finding the solution to a set of simultaneous equations. Generally speaking, we won't be having much trouble solving just a few equations. We're talking about implementations which are solving many thousands of equations at once. And so we need to look carefully at the numerical stability and the scalability of such algorithms. So we could just find the inverse matrix of coefficients in matrix form. So to find x, that's the unknown, in Ax equals b, we can proceed this way. But finding the inverse is an unnecessarily complex step if we're just interested in this final result, x, as we'll see. It can be numerically unstable and it can be additional work. So, in general, if we look at what happened with the straightforward worked example of schoolboy simultaneous equation solving, the school technique, is that we convert the matrix into this upper triangular form. We could convert it to a lower triangular form. It doesn't matter. That's just a permutation of the order. And then one of these is given straight away by substitution, back substitution, and then we get the other ones successively by further back substitutions. And so this is a good approach in general. If we have multiple right-hand sides, then what we'd like to do is decompose the problem, the coefficient matrix, into not only just a lower or an upper, but also its corresponding other half. This is called LU decomposition. And when we multiply them back together again, we'll have the original A. So if we have decomposed it in this way, then the equation that we're trying to solve overall, AX equals B, becomes LUX or LUX equals B. And then we can substitute if we think of UX as being Y, LUX equals B, then Y equals B. So LY equals B is the first step to do, and that we can call forward substitution if we wish. That is going to be completely straightforward because one of the coefficients in one of the rows in L will just have a single non-zero digit in it, so it gives us one of the values in Y straight away, and then we substitute as you might expect. Once we have Y, then we can do exactly the same to get X, which is what we're after overall. We multiply UX. We note that y is equal to ux, and so we just substitute again on that. And so the code for that, where's it gone? Is online, and you can play around with it. I flashed this up briefly at the end of last lecture. The procedure to generate one of the two triangular matrices is just what we expect from the school approach. The question is, where does the other one come from? And in fact, it is incredibly simple to get the other one in this straightforward code, which is just what you might expect by mechanizing what you do. You compute this value, mu, which is what you're going to multiply one of the rows by, and all you need to do is store these values of mu in another matrix, and that will be the other half of the solution. So you'll get L and U out of that. If you stare at the code, you'll see that fairly manifestly. Looking at it just in a more mathematical terms, this is the general situation that we have some 3x3 shown, but think of it as 1,000x1,000 or more. We're just going to find a pair of matrices. One, this is the lower one, that's the upper one, such that when we multiply them together, then we get back the original matrix. And you can sort of set it all out in matrix form if you like, on as is done on Wikipedia if you look there. Basically, the L array that we want is given by multiplying together a succession of sub-matrices GI, which consist of a leading diagonal of ones, all zeros everywhere else, except for some non-zero coefficients here, which turn out to be these pivot, dividing by the pivot element and multiplying by the leading value in a row. If you multiply a large number of matrices like this together, in fact, it's totally trivial if you work it through. Most of the time, you're just multiplying by a 1 or 0, and the only thing that these coefficients actually get multiplied by is a 1 or a 0, which is why the resultant matrix is nothing more than these values, which are the mu values in that program. So do a worked example, and you'll see it for yourself, or take my word for it, or read Wikipedia. Some of you might prefer to see it in this sort of matrix form. Others might just like to look at the code. But there's nothing magic going on at all here. One thing that it is worth noting is that there's a bit of redundancy here. The values are down the leading diagonal of L, and the values down the leading diagonal of upper, there's various possibilities which, when we multiply them together, give us back the original matrix. Information theory tells us this, in fact, because how many numbers do we have on the left? In this example, 9. How many on the right? 3, 4, 5, 6, 12. 12 numbers on the right, 9 on the left. We've converted 9 numbers into 12 numbers. There's presumably and probably more than one way of doing that. And the answer is yes, there is. And so another decomposition that we could commonly do is called a LDU decomposition, where the L matrix has ones on its leading diagonal, as does the upper matrix. And then D is another matrix which we stick in the middle, which is very much like the unit matrix, except that it has those numbers which are not 1, has a collection of numbers along the leading diagonal which are not 1. And then if you add together the total number of numbers that we have a unique decomposition. And so that's sometimes used as well. Or we could just say, let's have the upper triangular matrix have ones down here, which will force the value of the lower ones and that sort of thing. So there's quite a few variations. None of them are particularly surprising. That's the second half of the code, the substitutions to do ly equals b and ux equals y. If we actually run it, here is that code. We're going to do quite a bit of simultaneous equation solving in the last few lectures, so this has been put into a separate class, that code, so we can use it in a variety of places. And then there's a customer for that class called LUDemo, which has lots of print statements in it, which prints out what's going on at each point. If I run it on my little red laptop here, it doesn't work very well because my little red laptop's broken. I get some strange output. So fortunately, I ran it on another computer and saved the answers yesterday. So here's working output.txt. And here are the intermediate stages being printed out. Here's an input matrix. It's being successively converted into upper triangular form in these iterations as the Gaussian elimination proceeds by subtracting multiples of one row from another one. Then uh, And then it does it again to show that there's no further effect of applying the upper triangular form conversion to something that's already upper triangular. Then it prints out the lower matrix, which was just obtained by storing those values of mu in a separate matrix. And then it multiplies L and U together again, and it should give you the thing we started with. And then it tries to solve it for some simultaneous equations. And so one single right-hand side is tried, and we have to do the forward substitution, and that gives us x, a y, and then we have to do the backward substitution, and it gives us the answer. And the answer's gone slightly off the left of the projector, as usual. Move across. And the answer we get out is 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, that's the answer here. And then it substitutes it back in the original question, and does it work? And that's the original right-hand side. So it's all working nicely, which is what we expect. In fact, this example is pretty trivial, because the bottom row of the matrix in question is all ones, and so the answer is going to be very obvious from the input data. I won't go into that. So if we have this technique, we can now, because we've decomposed into L and U once, we can use that L and U decomposition for solving multiple right-hand sides. And one of the right-hand sides that we might care to solve for, multiple B, is so we have AX equals B. We might wish to solve for, supposing A was a 4 by 4, we could solve for that right-hand side. Is that big enough? But if we can do multiple right-hand sides at once, we'll put some more in. Let's solve for four right-hand sides which happen to have that pattern. They have the nice, pretty pattern. That is, of course, the identity matrix. So now we have solved for AX equals the identity matrix. What does that make X? Is anyone awake? The inverse of A. Yes, A times A to the minus 1 is the identity matrix by definition, and vice versa. So this has now given us a technique which is efficient if we want to find the inverse matrix. We solve for a special right-hand side, but we can solve for other right-hand sides in general without having first of all created the inverse matrix and then used it to multiply particular right-hand sides by, which will end up being less work and will be can generally be more numerically stable, I think. Certainly using Cramer's rule to get the inverse is a complete disaster for large arrays. And this sort of oops, I should change the button. You should shout at me if I haven't pressed the button. This sort of problem, solving large simultaneous equation systems, crops up all the time, and often there are special properties of the matrix of coefficients. Quite often, the matrix of coefficients itself is symmetric owing to the nature of the problem domain that we're solving, and sometimes it has other properties. This is a slide I was just looking, found this online. This was recent work, 2010, so only 6 years ago. Some people in CMU discovered a new algorithm for solving systems of simultaneous equations. Now, you might think that this is very old, boring stuff that was worked out decades ago by Newton or some of it even. I mean, the Gaussian elimination, I think Newton had something to do with that, and another chap called Jordan. Anyway, it's all very old in general, but yet still new things are being discovered for matrices which have particular properties. So this slide is for symmetric diagonally dominant matrices, whatever they are. The definition is given here, but it's some sort of condition on the structure of the coefficients, and these chaps have produced something called the Speedy algorithm, which is particularly good at solving those. And it turns out that is the sort of matrix that you get when you're Netflix and you're trying to recommend movies to customers. Now, I don't know much about Netflix. I subscribed last month. I didn't watch any films and cancelled my subscription before I was billed. That's my entire experience with Netflix, but one of my personal claims to fame is I'm a pioneer of broadband. I actually dug up Cambridge and installed fibre optic cable into all the colleges and to 50 homes and schools 20 years ago, or more, 25 years ago. And we ran video on demand. Nothing happened at all. Video DVD was invented. Videotapes went out of the shops. The DVDs came in. Blockbuster took over Britain. And now it's only actually in this last couple of years that Blockbuster's gone bust, and people are doing Netflix and things, but I'm not doing it. I'm just one of the inventors of that sort of thing 25 years ago. Anyway, so when I say that's my only involvement with Netflix, that's to miss out a large part of my life. But anyway, whatever those are, let's look at another class of matrices, which is actually on the syllabus. And these, this is a very old technique due to Cholesky. He has a decomposition of a matrix into a lower and upper, where the lower and upper are nice and efficient to find because the lower is the transpose of the upper. So, information theory tells us that we can't do this for general matrices. There's approximately n squared over 2 numbers in the answer, and if we had a perfectly general input matrix, then there would be n squared numbers in there. So we can't transform n squared numbers into n squared over 2. We would lose information. So this only works, for a particular class of matrices, and again, they are symmetric matrices, which means that the number of numbers in here is halved, essentially, and also that they are positive definite, which if you're a mathematician, you might well know what that means. It means some particular property you could look up about what is actually going to mean for us is none of these square roots go negative, which is perhaps the best definition for this course. But this particular property about the structure of the coefficients crops up a lot in real life. We're going to talk about circuit simulation in the next lecture, and that will generate these positive definite matrices. So just ignore the positive definite bit for the moment. Just assume it's a nice symmetric matrix, to use a less technical word. And what we can see is that these numbers on the right-hand side will just be general numbers, and we're going to decompose it into this. If we do the reverse, where we multiply these together, we'll get these answers back, and you can see by inspection, for instance, that the very first number here, L11, which is going to be on the leading diagonal here, if we multiply these two together, the top row of this and the first column of that is going to give us the number here, which is L11 squared. So we can see that number by inspection. The number we put here is a square root of the number that's provided there. And similarly, the other numbers in here are pretty obvious. In fact, all of them are obvious, but they just get slightly more complicated the bit further we go. So for instance, this one here, which is the second row of this matrix multiplied by the first column, is just going to be L11 times this first row. So that's L11 times L21 and L21 squared plus L22 squared. And this top right-hand corner here is not zeros. It is, I've got the word symmetric there, which means that L211, L11 is also there. This is filled in with the symmetric numbers, but we put the word symmetric in there to indicate that property without cluttering up the slide so much. So, what do we learn from this? That certain matrices have a sort of square root, if you like, two things which when multiplied together, or almost when multiplied together, we transpose it and multiply it by itself, will give us the original matrix back. And why is this helpful? Well, this matrix is a lower and this one is an upper, so we can use these for our simultaneous equation solving in the way that we've just seen for the general LU decomposition. But, so this is the procedure, we find, again we have lux equals b, we find y from ly equals b, and then we find x, not from u, but from lt, the transpose of l equals y. And this also has complexity order n cubed. Did I point out the n cubedness on the code? I think I did last time, that we have an outer for loop here. This pivot selection is optional, doesn't add any complexity to the order. Then there's another for loop here nested and a third one there. So this turns out to be 2/3 n cubed if you look at the constant coefficient. And Cholesky, because we still had to compute L and U, but they're both the same as each other, give or take a reorganization of permuting of X and Y, the array indices. So it's only half as much work to produce that. And if you work it all through, it comes out as a more efficient thing. These are the formulae for directly finding the values in here. It's not complicated to do. There's a program which does it. The formulae themselves are actually fairly obvious if you bother to spend the time and look at it. But I didn't. I just copied them out of an old textbook. But there's nothing magic going on. And if we run that one, then it doesn't work on my particular copy. Just had a little upset with my laptop, further upset, so that's not working. Have I got the... No? All right. I'll make it work for next time and fix it. Here's the code. The Cholesky or Cholesky decomposition of the input matrix as an array, square array, well, two-dimensional array of doubles, is given by this bit of code here, which is exactly what's on those equations with a square root. So the only thing that can possibly go wrong is the square root comes out negative. We want to take the square root of a negative number. That means that the input didn't have that nice positive definite property. Hopefully we checked it was symmetric, but in fact, if you look at this code, it'll only read one half of the input data. It will assume that the other half was the symmetric copy. And when you run this in reality, you can get a few rounding errors with these subtractions and cancellations, and you can occasionally get square root applied to some negative numbers owing to cancelling going wrong. But because we're clever people, we know where the input equations came from, we know that the situation was supposed to work perfectly for that particular application domain. And so if we get a negative number here to square root, then we know it was really just a rounding error and we'll return zero for the square root of the negative number. I suppose we could be a little bit more paranoid. We could check whether it's a massive negative number, in which case something's definitely gone wrong. But generally speaking, it will be a tiny negative number, which is just an accumulation of errors, and zero is the correct value that should have been there. And we can also avoid square rooting entirely by a variation on Kolesky, which is where we do a Kolesky LDU, and we have all ones down the leading diagonals here, and we have another matrix in the middle, which is a diagonal matrix, which has those numbers in it, but they didn't need to be square rooted in that version, so that's even more attractive. But the cost of square root is actually quite low. It's a Newton-Raphson iteration that's normally used, and that is very fast in convergence. It doesn't dominate the cost of this. And if we use the LDU variant, we can avoid that as well. So there's many years of experience gone into doing all of this, and this is just a sort of snapshot of some of the techniques which are very widely used. And there's further tricks we can do. What if our input matrix is not symmetric? Or Hermitian? I guess some of you have come across a Hermitian matrix. A Hermitian matrix is a variation on a symmetric matrix, but for real numbers, for complex numbers, I should say. And for complex numbers, the Hermitian is the conjugate transpose of that. So not only do we flip the numbers in the leading diagonal, we change the sign of the imaginary parts. So all of this maths works just as well for complex numbers as for real numbers, which is all I've been showing for you. So if we have a symmetric, non-symmetric, or for complex non-Hermitian matrix, there's another trick we can use, which is shown on the top of this slide, which is that if we first of all find the inverse of B multiplied by BT, where B is our input matrix, that product will always be symmetric, it turns out. And we now know how to find the inverse efficiently by doing an LU decomposition and then solving for the right-hand side, which is the identity function, the identity matrix. And then if we just pre-multiply or form this product here by pre-multiplying the inverse with B transpose, if you work that through, basically what we've got here is BT in the numerator and a BT in the denominator of this product, where the minus 1 is turning that second half into a denominator. So BT in the numerator and denominator cancel, and we're left with B to the minus 1. So, I don't know whether you want to learn that equation or not. It's just one of many, many sort of tricks which are reused in the real world by people who have to do this sort of thing, like the marketing execs at Netflix or Amazon. So we've looked at a few techniques. Which technique to use? Here's a summary slide for this part of the course. If the input coefficient is triangular, the input coefficient matrix is triangular to start with, then we don't need to do any further decomposition. We can just use it in that form and get the answer out. Otherwise, we can have a look to see whether the rows or the columns can be permuted to be triangular overall. That is a nice linear check to be done. We just need that there is a row. If we just tally the number of zeros in the rows in each row and each column and look for a pattern of integers, natural numbers in there, then we can see that there will be a permutation that will make it triangular. Sometimes the input rows and the columns together can be permuted to give us a triangular matrix, but that is a very hard and expensive search unless the input data is highly sparse, in which case the search space is greatly cut down. But most of the input data is zeros, which it often will be for circuits, which I'm going to talk about. In circuits, we have nodes interconnected by components. They might be water pipes interconnecting water tanks, or they might be transistors interconnected with resistors. that interconnection matrix is generally very sparse. There might be millions of transistors and resistors and so on in my integrated circuit, or billions these days, but each one's only connected to a few neighbours. And so sparse matrices do crop up a very great deal. So we can search in both directions at once with some smarter algorithms. If our array is symmetric and we know it from the way it's made, it has a particular positive definite structure, then we use Gillespie or Kolesky. I don't know how you say it. If none of the above, but at least the input is square, then if we have one right-hand side, we'll use school Gaussian elimination. Otherwise, we'll do for multiple right-hand sides, we'll do the LU decomposition. But actually, this is no additional complexity over this. The multiple right-hand side case just means that we keep the intermediate results in the other output matrix compared with directly applying them to the right-hand side that we have to hand in the one right-hand side case. A couple more possibilities. If we have a very tall array, then we, in simultaneous equations terms, we know of old that if we have n equations, then we can solve for n unknowns. If we have a very tall array, then we have many more equations than unknowns, and that is an overspecified problem. There's no unique solution. But what we can do is we can find a regression fit, i.e. we can find the set of coefficients which, although when we multiply them by the solution, doesn't give us exactly the right-hand side, it gives us the smallest variation from the right-hand side as possible, given by some metric, which normally we just use the sum of the squares of the differences, and we can minimizing that regret that difference is forming a solution, a best solution according to some metric to an overspecified system. And conversely, if the array is very fat, then we have many more unknowns than right hand sides. There are many possible solutions. Well, then we're basically being asked to find a solution out of many possible ones, and we'll need some additional metric function yet again, like the simulated annealing, which was demonstrated with just one dimension, but in general it can be multiply dimensioned, finding the solution which optimizes our cost metric in the way that we want. So that's about it for solving matrices of equations, linear equations we've looked at. We're going to look at a little bit of non-linear stuff in the circuit flow. But next we'll just have a little digression into some alternative technologies. There's a few miscellaneous slides here. So